Good morning, everyone. I'm call this meeting of State Government Finance and Elections Committee to order for March 11th, 2022. And pursuant to House Rule 10.01, this meeting is being held virtually. Mr. Brinks, can you take the roll?
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Present.
Nelson is present. Vice Chair Carlson. Representative Nash.
Carlson's present.
Carlson is present. Representative Nash.
Present.
Nash is present. Representative Bonner.
Present.
Bonner is present. Representative Drazkowski.
I think Drazkowski is going to be late, so he's excused till he gets here.
Drazkowski is excused. Representative Elkins.
Elkins here.
Elkins is present. Representative Greenman.
Present.
Greenman is present. Representative Cleburne.
Cleburne present.
Cleburne is present. Representative Kosnick.
Present.
Kosnick is present. Representative Mason.
Mason present.
Mason is present. Representative New Brindley.
Present.
New Brindley is present. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski is excused for the beginning of the meeting.
Pawlowski is excused. Representative Quam.
Inexcusably present.
Quam is present. Chair, with that, we have a quorum.
We have a quorum. With that, our first agenda item is approval of the minutes from May 10th. Representative Anderson or Carlson, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to move the minutes.
Approval of the minutes has been moved by Representative Carlson. All in favor, please unmute and say to vote. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. The minutes are approved. We have an aggressive agenda this morning, members, so we'll get right to it. The first bill on our agenda is House File 3853, Representative Davini, and I'll move House File 3853 to be before us, and the intent is to lay this over for possible inclusion. Representative Davini,
good morning,
you want to explain
Chair.
Your bill?
Oh, pardon me. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for this opportunity. I'm excited to be in front of the State Gov Finance Committee today. This may be a first for me. I had to punch this ticket before I leave the body, Mr. Chair. So thank you for the opportunity. Members, as you know, Minnesota currently has three state ethnic councils that function as state agencies, staffed with the responsibility to advise the executive and legislative branches on concerns of their communities. The Council on Latino Affairs, the Council of Minnesotans of African Descent, and the Council of Asian Pacific Minnesotans. In addition, of course, we have the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. And members of this committee, I know some at least have served as legislative liaisons on some of these councils. Minnesota currently has in statute language that establishes the Minnesota Youth Council with some of the same important responsibilities to advise the governor and legislature. The Minnesota Youth Council is also empowered by statute, if it chooses, to select bills to be heard before its committee, propose legislation, prepare advisory opinions, and even prepare an omnibus bill. And members, if you haven't presented a bill before the Minnesota Youth Council, you don't know how intimidating that can be to face a group of engaged, intelligent, knowledgeable young people grilling you on your bill. While the responsibilities of the Minnesota Youth Council are not exactly the same as those of the Ethnic Council, the potential is there, especially if we were to provide the same level of status or support. The Minnesota Youth Council, instead of being a small state agency as the Ethnic Councils or the American Indian Council is operated by a nonprofit outside of the state and has not received state support until this biennium when they received one-time funding through the K-12 budget. As one of the letters of support that you'll find in your packet today says, young people are underrepresented in all levels of government and leadership. This bill is an attempt to respond to that underrepresentation and affirm the importance of youth voice, engagement, and insight into the policymaking process. With me today, Mr. Chair, we're lucky to have the policy director of the Minnesota Alliance with Youth, and three representatives from the Minnesota Youth Council. If I could hand it over to them. I'd appreciate it.
And I have a list of testifiers here. Chair Dabney, I'll start with Halla Henderson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for taking the time to hear HF 3853 today. My name is Halla Henderson. I am the policy director for the Minnesota Alliance with Youth, and I have the privilege of working alongside the Minnesota Youth Council as they navigate informing and influencing bodies such as this about the obstacles that our youth experience. In a few moments, you'll have the opportunity to hear from some of the incredible young people that I work with, and I hope that you provide them with the same level of attentiveness that you've shown me. When the Minnesota Youth Council was signed into law through the leadership of Representative Marquardt, we became the first state, to our knowledge, to mandate youth voice. And through that work, our young people have spent the last 9 years testifying before committees such as this, partnering with youth organizations, and offering guidance to state agencies and decision makers. They've worked alongside MDE, held community forums and events, and in moments of crisis have pivoted to quickly ensure our youth have the most up-to-date knowledge possible. Currently, our structure is made up of 36 young people between 8th and 12th grade. We have 4 students from each congressional district and 4 at-large members. And through this legislation, we would expand our age parameters to include young adults and to reach that really important demographic of young Minnesotans. We're excited about this bill because it allows us to think about our work in sustainable and forward-thinking ways. When we've imagined and thought about the ways in which the council needs to continue to do the great work that it does, it's one where staffing and resources can be devoted solely to that work, and where our young people recognize that the importance of their voice is recognized no matter their zip code or their proximity to the Capitol. Our young people see an urgent need to connect with their peers around civic and community engagement, and we believe this legislation will make that path easier and more transparent, both for the folks at the Capitol who support and fund this work, and then also for our community and our young people as we bring them into these spaces. As you read the letters of support, you'll probably notice a reoccurring theme. Our young people provide needed knowledge and energy around really big issues. They tackle the things that they know their peers care about, and they also tackle the smaller, more nuanced policy decisions with a level of intent and care that is needed in these spaces. This legislation is a further investment in that work. So I would like to turn it over to my young people who can speak to that a little bit in a clearer sense. And thank you again for hearing this legislation and to Representative.
Recording in progress. Recording stopped.
I believe so.
I dropped off for a second there. Is Sage with us?
Yes, I am. Sorry.
Identify yourself for the record, then, and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to share my thoughts. My name is Sage Hartman, and I'm currently a sophomore at Wayzata High School and live in Congressional District 3. This year is my second year on the Minnesota Youth Council, and I'm a part of the Mental Health and Wellbeing Subcommittee. I'm in support of House File 3853 because the youth voice is crucial to implement into legislation. Youth voice is crucial. I'm not only saying this from the perspective of someone who's a part of Minnesota Youth Council, I'm saying this as a student who can recognize the unique and educational perspective that other students have. This bill would help make the perspective that is currently so underrepresented more heard and understood. Personally, as a member of today's youth, I've talked to many of my peers about why they hesitate to share their opinions, and it usually comes back to one common response: lack of opportunities. This bill, if passed, would help make sure that the students and youth have opportunities to not only be seen in legislative process, but to be heard. This bill would also help amplify youth voices from all backgrounds and help implement new perspectives for people who are directly experiencing the effects of legislation. More specifically, when I say that legislation directly impacts us, I mean that the youth is consistently affected when it comes to laws around education, mental health, individual rights, environment, and many more. And because we're so impacted by everything happening around us, it's crucial that us representatives of the youth can use our voice and be heard. This bill will not only help youth be heard, it will help us make change throughout Minnesota as a whole. Thank you for supporting this bill and passing it on.
Thank you for your testimony, Sage. The next person I have is Eric Lee. Thank you, Mr. Lee. Identify yourself and then proceed.
Hello, my name is Eric Lee, and I'd like to thank Chair Nelson and members of the committee for hearing House File 3853, and thank you so much for being here and taking time off your busy schedules. My name is Eric Lee, like I mentioned above, and I'm a junior at Egan High School. Currently, I've been a representative of Congressional District 2 on the Minnesota Youth Council for 2 years now, where I've served on the Juvenile Justice Subcommittee and the Environmental Justice Subcommittee. I'm here today to ask you to push House File 3853, as it's not only necessary for our future success, but it can propel the voices of the youth in Minnesota to a level not seen before that combats against a lack of youth engagement that is seen across Minnesota. Being on the Minnesota Youth Council has already led me to becoming a better advocate. The hearings with legislators actually make me feel that the youth voice matters when it comes to the government. The connections that I've made are astonishing. From working on projects to creating criminal justice reform to working on advocacy in the public health dimension, all of these connections are connections forwarded through the Minnesota Youth Council that can help the community that I represent. Now, you may ask, if we've done so much already, why is this bill necessary? But we think that this can only lead to further net beneficial outcomes at the local and state level. The bill can not only increase the administrative support, which can allow the MYC to receive more services, but also can provide more opportunities and representations. With the government's administrative support, think about the increase in hearings that we can have with legislators and the additional letters of support that we can send out to support more bills with the backing of the youth. With the government's administrative support, think about the connections we can make with more community partners, more events that we can start up, such as the Youth Day at the Capitol and Youth Education Leadership Summit, and more outreach that we can have statewide. For all those reasons, so proud to support this legislation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. The next person I have is Salma Abdi. I hope I said that properly. And welcome to the committee. Say your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Salma Abdi. Thank you, Chair Nelson and members of the committee. You did pronounce my name right. My name is Salma Abdi, and I'm a senior at Century High School in Rochester, Minnesota. This is my final year as a Minnesota Youth Council representative, and the Minnesota Youth Council has made me the advocate I am today. I've been able to work on local issues and national issues by utilizing the skills and education I received as a Minnesota Youth Council representative. I was able to push for my high school to get a constitutional amendment for our student government to allow PSEO students to be a part of it. So why is this bill important? This bill would modernize how our state government seeks out young voices, because as we become increasingly more aware of the world's challenges, having us at the table should no longer be an option, but rather a must. The institutionalization of the Minnesota Youth Council would expand our ability to advise the governor and the state legislature, allowing you all to be connected with young people in your congressional district, giving you a semblance of what we want and need. It'll allow for elected officials to hear directly from non-voting constituents, because while we do not have that civic right just yet, our experiences and opinions matter just as much as the people who elected you. Furthermore, we are not just the future leaders of tomorrow. We are leaders of today with the unique position to critically understand youth issues and advocate for it. The Minnesota Youth Council is the organization that creates today's leaders, educating us via hands-on experience of how our state legislature works and offering us opportunities like this one to speak in front of you. House File 3853 will allow the Minnesota Youth Council to become a state agency, and pushing for it is to revolutionize not just how Minnesota views young people's voices, but will also allow for other states to follow Minnesota's lead, to reimagine how states can uplift young voices. Thank you for listening on the importance of House File 3853 and pushing to have our voices heard today.
Thank you, Ms. Abdi. Members, any questions of the author? Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. I serve on the Council of Asian Pacific Islander Minnesotans, and just wondering what will the changes be in staffing for this if this were to get passed into law? And I don't see a fiscal note. I was wondering if there has been one requested.
Representative Daphne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nash. One fiscal note has been requested to go to your last question first, and is still in process. So that's what we know about that. In your packet, I believe there is a letter of support from the Council of Asian Pacific Minnesotans. I hope I'm right about that. One of the ethnic councils, and I may be, it may be the Council on Latino Affairs that provided a letter of support. I've met with each of the ethnic councils as well as the Minnesota American Indian Council, pardon me, and all were open to this conversation. And I'm not proposing any changes in their funding as part of this legislation.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the staffing, like I work with Ms. Herr, she's got a full complement of staff, all of which are paid. That's not going to change from where you are now, or that would change, and the upcoming fiscal note would reflect that. I'm not sure which.
And are you asking if staff levels would change, Representative Nash, for the other ethnic councils or for this council?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair, for the clarification. Yes, I'm asking if there is going to be additional staff required to do this, if it's going to be granted the same level of standing as the Asian Pacific councils and the Latino councils and so on. I just wanted to make sure, and I'm sure if that's the case, it'll be reflected in the fiscal note, but just wanted to ask the author.
Representative Daphne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, thanks for asking that clarifying question, because I was misunderstanding Representative Nash's initial question. This would create a state agency parallel to the ethnic councils and the American Indian Council in state statute and in state government. So there will be a fiscal impact. It will not negatively, I'm not proposing negatively impacting any of the existing councils. But as I indicated in my opening comments, Representative Marcourt led the creation of this, the Minnesota Youth Council 10 years ago. They've never received any state funding until this current biennium. This would, they would evaluate what the staffing needs are, and the state would provide for those as we do the other ethnic councils.
Representative Nash.
Nothing further.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Mason.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I have signed on to this bill, and I strongly encourage the support of this. I've worked with youth on numerous occasions, and their expertise and ability to advocate is incredible. And in some cases, and I'll go back to when I was a city council, where I was meeting with a group of teenagers, and we were trying to get a teen center. And the reason I'm, my council prohibited people from our parks department to meet with us. We had people from the Y, from the county, every aspect. But my city council would not let our city staff participate in getting a teen center for our teens. And today there still really is no involvement per se by our teens in city government. So I'm thinking this gives us a real opportunity to make sure that at least there is one place where our teenagers or students can really participate. And I can tell you, I mean, I am so very, very impressed in what they know. And I'm thinking also they probably may not have some of the hangups that we have right now, just because we're involved with a number of other things. And especially I see, I know there's one young woman from my district that's on the council, and her particular deal is dealing with the environment. So, I mean, as I said, I can't encourage you to vote yes, enough. This is really huge. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mason. I see no further questions, no further hands up. Representative or Chair Dabney, if you want to wrap up your bill, and then we'll lay this over.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And first, let me thank the testifiers today. I think it was an opportunity for members to hear directly from the youth who are already involved and see the insights that are available, the articulate individuals that are already engaged, then the leadership that is developing there. We all know that younger people are less likely to be engaged in the electoral political process. I think we, as a state, suffer because of that. And opportunities for young people to be more engaged in the policy setting process, Mr. Lee referenced to a net benefit. I think it benefits the youth in their development. It also benefits us in having a more comprehensive and holistic view of the needs and preferences of constituents across the state. This proposal provides a structure where we can access those insights and that leadership to better do our jobs. I ask for your support. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I appreciate the opportunity to present the bill this morning.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Next bill we have on our list of Representative Schultz, but we're working some issues out. So we're going to go to Representative Hansen, House File 3394. And members, I'll move House File 3394 to be referred to the General Register. Representative Hansen, if you want to explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 3394 is a bit unique in that it is a House resolution. I think the last one of these that I authored was the Great Lakes Compact Resolution back in the late 2000s. So it differs from a law change in terms of that it is a resolution. You're not required on the floor to vote for a resolution. But what this does is it memorializes Congress to name the post office in South St. Paul, Officer Leo Pavlak. Now, those of you who are history buffs may remember in the 1930s, the Barker-Karpus gang. And in the 1930s, during the Depression, bank robberies, people robbed banks because that's where the money was. And you know, the stockyards in South St. Paul were a source of money during the 1930s. Officer Pavlak was killed in an ambush outside of the post office in 1933. And so what this would do, it's my understanding that all members of a congressional delegation need to agree on naming of a post office. And this bill is a resolution to Congress encouraging them to name the post office in memory of Officer Pavlak. We have with us Commander Wickey, who is the current chief of the South St. Paul Police. And in your packet, there is a letter from the Pavlak family supporting this resolution. So, Officer Wickey.
And Representative Hansen, there's no truth that you were there to witness the event.
But no, anyway, we'll go to... No.
Anyway, we'll go to Commander Wickey. Welcome to the committee, Commander Wickey. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, members of the committee. My name is Brian Wickey, and I am currently the commander for the South St. Paul Police Department. I'm here today on behalf of the South St. Paul Police Department and the City of South St. Paul expressing our support for House File 3394 and the resolution supporting the naming of the post office for Officer Leo Pavlak. The resolution as written does a great job, as did Representative Hansen, explaining the facts that led up to Officer Pavlak's brutal murder in 1933. My point here today is I'd like to make sure that the members of this committee are aware of the legacy of service that Officer Pavlak brought to the state of Minnesota. And I'll briefly summarize that. At the time of Officer Pavlak's death, he was survived by two children. His son, Robert, went on to serve in the U.S. Marines. He served his entire career with the St. Paul Police Department. And importantly for this group, he served in the Minnesota House in the late 60s and the early 70s. Towards the tail end of his career, Robert Pavlak was appointed as the U.S. Marshal for the District of Minnesota and served in that capacity for a good portion of the 1980s. Robert Pavlak's children, two of note, Bob and Dave went on to serve in law enforcement as well, continuing that legacy of service. Bob serving with the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office throughout the duration of his career, and David with the St. Paul Police Department. Very self-serving and important to the city of South St. Paul, is within the past year, we have brought on Bob's son, Ryan, to the South St. Paul Police Department, coming full circle in that legacy of the Pavlak family and their service to not only the metro area, but the state of Minnesota. With that said, I am here to stand for any questions and offer our wholehearted support in support of House File 3394.
Any questions of the testifier or the author? And Representative Mason, you still have your hand up from the last time?
Yep.
Thank you. Any questions of the testifier or the author? I'm seeing no hands popping up. Representative Hansen, if you want to quickly wrap up, and then we will take the vote.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and Commander Wiki and the Pavlak family for their service. I'd ask for your support in moving this to the general register. I think it's an important way that we can recognize the sacrifice of Officer Pavlak. Thank you for, I would encourage you to co-author. There's plenty of space on the co-author list, and I'd invite you to co-author as this moves forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, members, I will renew my motion that House File, get the number right here, 3394, be referred to the General Register. Mr. Brinks, will you take the roll?
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson votes aye. Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Carlson votes aye. Representative Nash.
Aye.
Nash votes aye. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner votes aye. Representative Drazkowski.
Aye.
Drazkowski votes aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins aye.
Elkins votes aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman votes aye. Representative Cleburne.
Cleburne aye.
Cleburne votes aye. Representative Kosnick.
No.
Kosnick votes nay.
No, I'm sorry. Kosnick aye.
Kosnick votes aye. Representative Mason.
Mason aye.
Mason votes aye. Representative New Brindley.
Aye.
New Brindley votes aye. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski, aye.
Pawlowski votes aye. Representative Quam. Representative Quam. Chair, with a vote of 12 ayes and one abstained, the motion prevails.
I would say Quam's excused instead of abstained. The motion approved, the bill's on its way to the general register. The next bill we have is House File 4069, also a Hansen bill. And House File 4069, I will move. And we're going to lay this one over, I believe, is what we decided for right now. There's some issues of where it needs to go. And we figure that out. We will move it at a later date. Representative Hansen, I'll move House File 4069 to have it before us. And if you want to explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This is a bill relating to the legislative auditor. Senator Cran is the chief author in the Senate. And this was an account that for data security that was set up several years ago, but because of a veto, the money was not appropriated. And you'll see that there's a lot of strike through in this bill. I have with me Ms. Lason from the legislative auditor to give some perspective on the bill.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Lason. If you want to identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Lori Lason. I am the Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Financial Audit Division at the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And I want to thank you today, Mr. Chair and members, for allowing me to testify today and for Representative Hansen for introducing this bill. This is the state data security account was established in 2014, and the revenue was directed to the Office of the Legislative Auditor. However, the governor did veto the appropriation language. And as a result, no one has had the authority to access this account since it was established. And so the balance currently is at approximately $1.3 million and continues increasing at approximately $225,000 a year. So by appropriating this revenue to our office, it's going to allow us to use these funds to increase the number of positions in our office and also allow us to add additional audits throughout the year. Our primary focus on adding additional positions will be with individuals who have background in auditing, financial statements and financial audits, IT audits, and also with fraud investigations. Thank you again for hearing this. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
We'll hold the questions till after our next testifier. I have on my list a Mark Havman. Could you introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Mark Havman, Executive Director of the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence. I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning in support of House File 4069. I'll be very brief, as I know you have a very full agenda, but our interest in this bill stems from the news reports on how the office is being inundated with requests for audits, evaluations, and special reviews, stressing its capacity. And it prompted us to take a look at how the budget and staffing of the OLA has evolved over time. And what we found was actually quite startling to us. Since 2003, total state spending per year from all government operating funds has increased 147% by over $33 billion. Over that same time, OLA's staffing levels have decreased from 80 to its current 56 full-time equivalent employees. So you put those figures together, it translates into one auditor or one program evaluator or one special review professional for every $1 billion the state spends annually. As state government continues to increase in scope and scale and complexity, it is imperative to invest in the high quality trusted government oversight and evaluation infrastructure that the OLA provides. We strongly encourage your support of this bill and hope this modest effort foreshadows additional investments which citizens deserve and good government demands. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Havman. With that, members, any questions? Representative Bonner.
We have a little bit better definition around the original intent of these funds and specifically what types of activities were intended to be these funds were intended to be used for, because I have found that in the description that we've had, that seems to be quite lacking.
Representative Hansen.
I would defer to Ms. Layson.
Ms. Layson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the original bill, it did have specific language that stated that we would review and audit driver records, subscription services, and bulk data practices of the Department of Public Safety, including identifying any deficiencies and making recommendations to the commissioner.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Leeson, and can you explain from an IT perspective what additional cyber or security measures they were hoping to gain from those activities?
Ms. Layson, you have to understand we have a few IT people on this committee that have a depth of knowledge in IT. So, Ms. Layson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Unfortunately, I don't know exactly. I'm not sure the intent of the exact language in the bill in the past. But I do know that we did do an audit in 2020 of bulk data sales. And that was really just about the privacy of that information. So unfortunately, I do not have the history of the intent of that language. I apologize.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Ms. Layson. I will say, you know, I understand the intent here is to make sure that the auditor can access the funds, which was in the original language. I do notice that a great deal of the oversight is now been stricken in that process. And the other part that I find a little bit troubling about this bill is that I don't have a clear definition of what the intent of this fund was supposed to accomplish. And that seems quite lacking. And I find it a little bit troubling that we do not know what the original intent of these funds is, but we're going to authorize a department to use funds that were specifically set aside without clear definition on the intent of what those funds were to be used for. That is all I have for today, but I just want to let the members know that I have concerns.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we have a definition or explanation of what the veto did to these funds and why that made it unusable?
Ms. Layson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The language, so it still allowed us to do these audits. However, it was the funding itself that was the language that was vetoed. So we just didn't have access to that money. So it's been in the special revenue account accruing at, as I said before, approximately $225,000 a year. But there has been no one who has had access to this account. So as a result, it's now approximately $1.3 million. Thank you.
Representative Nash.
Nothing further.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an odd situation we have here. So the money has continued to accrue, but there is no access to the account. And actually, Representative Bonner, I appreciate your questions. I think that they were sound. My question is, well, I guess, have these audits continued to happen without the funding, or have these just not been audits that have been selected?
Ms. Layson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, in 2020, we did do an audit of the bulk data sales, and we still do have the discretion of doing audits at the Department of Public Safety. However, we do have to balance that with audits of other state entities. So if we were to go to the Department of Public Safety, and that was something that was required of us more often, with funding to do so would give us that opportunity to go there more often. But currently, as it sits, again, we just simply do not have enough auditors to spread throughout the state and do audits as often as maybe the legislature would like us to do so.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Layson. I guess my question for Representative Hansen, just to make sure I understand, is this account still accruing money?
Representative Hansen, I think he said that already, but yes, Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Brindley, my understanding is yes. And so without the legislation, it will accrue, but will not be appropriated. So that's why the bill is here. As Ms. Layson said, if we, the auditor and the audit commission have the discretion to do audits, but there's only so much money and only so many staff. And so here you have money accruing, but is not being used. Nonpartisan staff may have the legislative history or could provide that to the committee.
But that's okay.
Representative Brindley, do you want to have Mr. Gehring, if he has any history on this?
Well, I guess just to ensure that, yes, it is still indeed accruing, I guess that would be a good question to have answered. That would be good to know.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Gehring. And please state your name again and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, Matt Gehring from House Research. My understanding is the same as what's been described here already, that the money continues to accrue in the account. And because there is not an appropriation of the balance of the account, then it just remains in that account and is not able to be used. And Ms. Roberts is also on if you have more fiscal questions about that.
That's great.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Gehring. I appreciate that. That was helpful. So my question is then, are there other special revenue accounts that help fund the OLA, or is this a unique situation?
I think I'll ask Ms. Roberts if you have information on that.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe that
the remainder of the OLA's funding is all from the general fund appropriation from the state government finance bill. I can double check on that to see if there are any other sources, but certainly the majority of their funding, if not all of it, comes from the general fund.
And you want to identify yourself for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Helen Roberts from the House Fiscal Staff.
Thank you, Helen. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Roberts. I appreciate that. I guess then my question is, I mean, this has been, it was created in 2014, and it sounds like there's a little over $1 million that has accrued since 2014. So, frankly, in legislative terms, in state budget terms, it has not been accruing a large amount of money quickly. And so I guess for me, it is odd that we would even continue. It seems more appropriate to me that we would repeal the special revenue fund, send that money back to the general fund, and kind of be done with it. We fund the OLA through the general fund. I certainly am very supportive of the OLA and making sure they have the resources we need, but this feels a little like a backdoor approach at this stage of the game. And so I guess my preference would be if the OLA needs additional funding, that we bring that back through the normal process and continue to fund that through the general fund. But I guess I'm a little concerned about how we are choosing to deal with this special revenue fund now, and it seems like a repealer may be a more appropriate course of action. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen.
And Representative Brindley and members, that's why we're laying this over. There's some question. Originally, we're going to set up to Ways and Means, but this money goes into it comes from the DPS, and we don't have authority over the DPS, so this might have to go to transportation, and when we get that worked out, we'll figure that out. They would be the ones if they wanted to eliminate this fund, because it comes out of from the public. It requires the Department of Public Safety to allocate 30% of fees charged on bulk sale of vehicle data. And again, that's under the purview of the Transportation Committee. So we're going to lay this over, and when we find out where it needs to go, we'll send it there. Representative Bonner, you have your hand up again.
Thank you. And perhaps Mr. Gehring can speak to this. I'm curious if we have a better understanding of the driver that was behind creating this specialty account. It seems like a clear attempt to sort of self-sustain certain activities, but the question from the language in statute talks about the data requirements and so forth, but it really doesn't give a clear understanding of what the intent was here again, and what was the driver behind creating this mechanism in the first place. And maybe, Mr. Gehring, you have some background information that might be helpful.
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonner, I have a bit of history I can share, probably not the depth that you might be looking for, but there is an existing, so in 2014, there were issues with how bulk vehicle records were being sold and how the subscription process works. And that has been an issue that the legislature has been interested in for a number of years. And in that year, there was a requirement put in statute that subscribers to these data sales programs were required to conduct audits periodically to review that the data is being sold and received is properly authorized by law and other issues like that. And so this account and the sort of direction to the legislative auditor to do the audits comes out of that requirement that these subscribers contract for an audit to be conducted. And that's if you look at the stricken language in the bill, that's the cross-reference that you see that's being stricken is to that requirement that there be a periodic audit of the bulk sales of these data. So that's how it kind of connects. It's there's more than just this specific account at issue. It's a kind of bigger question about the way the Department of Public Safety sells bulk vehicle registration data.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you. And Mr. Gehring, is the intent here to also look at how that data is being used, and specifically how private personal information may be used that comes from this data?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonner, that is one of the issues that the legislature has been interested in, is there are certain authorized uses of these data when they get sold. And so part of the questions that have come up periodically is whether, in fact, they're being used for those purposes. And so I think the answer to your question is yes.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing I would suggest is that, you know, there are very distinct and clear guidelines about how we use personal data in any capacity. And I'm not sure if we have clear definition on how we're using this data in statute, and perhaps we could follow up with me afterwards. But so I'm a little bit unclear as to the intent here again, but I also am a little bit nervous about the idea of, if we have very specific need and we are taking out all of the language here that gives direction, that we're basically saying we're just going to give all that money back to the OLA. Not that the OLA is not deserving to have that money, but it feels like we are going about this in a very, very odd way. And if there is a real need for this type of information or to do this type of audit, it makes me wonder how we should be appropriately funding that and whether this is the right mechanism to do that. So in an odd situation, I think that Representative New and I may have a little bit more in common than we differ in that. But I guess I think it feels like there is more information that should be sussed out on this particular bill before we proceed. And I know that the intent is to lay this over, so I'll leave it there.
And members, with that, we'll lay this bill over, and hopefully, but when we come back, when we figure out where it's got to go, and then some of these issues, again, with the DPS, can be sussed out. If it has to go to transportation, it's probably the appropriate place for that. So we'll lay this bill over. Thank you, Representative Hansen. And I don't think you thought this was going to be that controversial. Members, the next bill on our agenda is House File 3696, Representative Schultz. And Representative Schultz, I understand the bill DE hasn't got to us yet. The DE that was put on in another committee didn't get engrossed and sent to us. So we're basically going to have an informational hearing on this bill so that we can see what part of it is we are a part of it. My understanding, it touches a little bit of CGIP funding, and that's why it's in front of us. So Representative Schultz, if you want to present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. House File 3696 is a bill to help us better understand what we pay for health care in Minnesota. And I know Ms. Rudolph did send out the DE amendment that was adopted on March 2nd in the Health Finance and Policy Committee. So all of you should have that in your inboxes. And it just removes some language. It does not change the section of the bill that's relevant for this committee. And the relevance was, does this bill impose a cost on CGIP? And the fiscal note came back that it does not. It's a zero cost. So I'll just describe a little bit about the bill. Basically, it increases the amount of information we're collecting in the APCD, which is the All Payer Claims Database. Currently, we're just getting claims that are paid. And right now, the healthcare industry is moving towards other types of payments that are sometimes called value-based payments. So we're requiring in this bill that all types of payments to healthcare providers are collected in the APCD. And this bill was developed with input of a very broad primary care coalition that includes family physicians, advanced practice registered nurses, the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care, and many of our healthcare systems. Over the last decade or more, there's been a real emphasis on reforming how we pay for health care services, really moving away from the fee-for-service volume-based payments towards these outcomes, population health metrics. And regardless of where you are politically, I think most agree that we need to reward value and improve population health with the correct incentives. Currently, most payers are incorporating value payments into their reimbursement systems, but we really don't have a good idea of how that is being done or how much of that is being done. Most value-based payments are not included in a claim. They are extra payments based on meeting certain quality matrix, based on reducing hospital readmissions, for instance, or healthcare home payments that coordinate care. Most of these payments are not included in an insurance claim, so they're not being collected by the all-payer claims database. This bill changes that to authorize the collection on non-claims-based payments, including value-based payments. The Commissioner of Health is directed to consult with payers and providers to develop the best way to collect this data, and the reporting will begin in 2024. In the interim, this bill directs the Commissioner of Health to provide a report by February 15th, 2023, on the total payments made that are non-claims-based payments and the percentage of those payments that are for primary care services. The primary care payments will be combined with the report they did in 2021 that looked at primary care services paid through by claims. And I do have one testifier, Dr. Deb Ditburner. She's the president of the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians.
Welcome to the meeting, Ms. Ditburner, or Dr. Ditburner. If you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Nelson and committee members, my name is Dr. Deb Ditburner. I'm a family physician and chief medical officer practicing in Alexandria, Minnesota at Alamere Health, one of the few remaining county hospitals, county-owned hospitals left in Minnesota. I am also the current president of the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians. The MAFP is the largest physician specialty organization in Minnesota with more than 3,100 family physicians, residents, and medical students from across our state. I have been a member and deeply involved with the MAFP since I was a medical student at the University of Minnesota. Today, I'm here to testify in strong support of HF 3696. This bill is needed to update all payer claims database, known as the APCD, to ensure that it collects a complete picture on how healthcare is paid in Minnesota. Currently, it only collects payments that are claims-based. That represents the transactional care that we do in medicine, the fee-for-service. It is missing a large and rapidly growing portion of payments, non-claims-based payments. These include value-based payments, infrastructure costs, complex care coordination, and other patient support services. Increasingly, these non-claims-based payments affect the way that I, as a physician and others in my practice, provide care for patients, and these are not found on the claim. They support opportunities to creatively engage with patients outside the face-to-face office visit model or that fee-for-service model. We can improve measurable clinical outcomes like blood sugar levels in patients with diabetes or depression levels in those with mental health by developing an outreach system via care coordinators, social workers, pharmacists, behavioral health professionals, and community health workers by using the whole primary care team. Value-based payments support primary care providers to care for patients with increasing complexity, patients with multiple complex chronic diseases, and or multiple social determinants of health. Minnesota's APCD was created in 2008. It has been an invaluable tool to use to analyze variations in healthcare costs and quality. However, more and more peers are using value-based payments, risk-based payments, and partial capitation. As CMO of a health system, I realize the rapidly growing rate of these payments from our peers right in Alexandria. This bill authorizes the Department of Health to begin collecting non-claims-based payments information in 2024, but in the interim, the bill directs the department to develop a report by February 2023 on the percentage of total payments that are non-claims-based and the percentage of those payments that are for primary care services. The triple aim, and now commonly called the quadruple aim, is my North Star as I care for patients and as I lead in healthcare. Decrease the costs, improve the quality, improve the patient experience, and guard the resiliency of all the healthcare workers. The newer payment models I've described help achieve the quadruple aim, especially when spent on complex and continuous primary care through teamwork. data from the Primary Care Collaborative and the Milbank Foundation show that investing more in advanced and continuous primary care achieves the quadruple aim. Yet according to recent MDH study, only about 6% of health spending goes to primary care in Minnesota. We need a more complete picture of healthcare spending in our state to truly understand the needs and gaps. Without this additional data, how do we, all of us here, develop and set a vision for healthcare systems that work for Minnesotans and is aligned with the quadruple aim? The pandemic has helped shine a light on the value and need for primary care, preventative services, and mental health care. And it has continued to show us that the fee-for-service payment system supporting volume over value does not work. And perhaps most obvious, the pandemic has highlighted healthcare disparities and inequities that affect too many of the residents of Minnesota. HF 3696 is critical to know how healthcare is currently paid for in Minnesota and to help inform us on next steps to make the healthcare payment system work best for our state and the Minnesotans we all serve. Thank you for your support of HF 3696, and I am happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Doctor. And we also have Stefan Gildemeister here from the MDH to answer any questions. And I see I have Representative Elkins. We have your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so quite questions, but I just additional almost testimony. I'm a co-author on this bill, and I have been following this topic very closely. It's clear that Minnesota health insurers are increasingly moving to these value-based incentives, and this is a very positive development. It is resulting, as Dr. Ditburner mentioned, in greater emphasis on preventative services so that people don't get sick in the first place, so that their acute conditions don't spin out of control. The purpose of this bill is really more for us more than anyone else. It's to provide us with the information that we need as policymakers to follow what's going on in this development so that we can craft intelligent legislation to promote it going forward. Health Partners is one of the insurers that is has a value-based payment system like this, and these are incentive payments over and above what a provider would receive in addition to their claims-based payments. They're very open as an example of, you know, how their program works, what the incentives are. I've read their description. It makes a ton of sense. This is something that we need to encourage, but in order to help promote this trend ourselves, we need the information about how this is working in the all-payer claims database is the place where we assemble the data so that analysts like Mr. Gildemeister are able to give us the policy recommendations that we need.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative New Brindley. You have a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is actually for you, Mr. Chair. While I certainly appreciate that you are treating this as an informational hearing at this point, will you be bringing this back up later for questions once we've had time to actually review the language? I'm afraid that these 5 minutes are not really sufficient time to review the language and be prepared to intelligently ask questions on the bill.
Representative Brindley, yes, when this comes back up, we'll have some questions. I have a question right now for Ms. Roberts. Ms. Roberts, Representative Schultz said that that according to the fiscal note, that this does not affect any budget that we oversee. And I guess if you can explain the fiscal notes, I see there's a preliminary or there's two notes for this. So, Ms. Roberts, can you explain the fiscal notes and does it have an impact on our budget?
Mr. Chair, again, Helen Roberts from the House Fiscal Staff. Any impact from this change would be reflected in the State Employee Insurance Fund, or CGIP. So, and as the fiscal note notes at this point, there's not enough information to determine that there would be a fiscal impact. It would not impact any general fund budget that this committee is responsible for. It would, if there are any additional costs, even they would be spread across the entire CGIB fund and wouldn't require additional state appropriations.
So, Ms. Roberts, would we need to hear the full bill again, or can we just have it sent elsewhere where it needs to be heard? Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, that's certainly your decision, but since you've had an informational hearing about the bill, I think it would be up to the members.
And Representative Schultz, you're lifting your hand.
Yeah.
Was it referred to us from the last committee?
It was referred because we didn't know whether there could potentially be a CGIB cost. So we just received that fiscal note. So if we had that fiscal note earlier, I don't think we needed to come to this committee. So my advice to members is to move this to, I think it's going to Judiciary because it has this data issue, and not hear it again because it does not impact your budget jurisdiction.
If it comes to us and we finally get possession, we either get rid of it or move it two ways. One is by motion on the floor, but otherwise we have to hear it and vote it out of here. Representative Brinkley, I see your hand up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. And I just want to clarify with Ms. Roberts. It sounds like we're not saying that there is no cost to CGIP, as Representative Schultz indicated. You said that we don't have enough information. Did I hear that correctly?
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair and Representative Brinley, I'm sorry, I'm working off my iPad, so I can't really pull the fiscal note up at the same time. But as I recall, there was some discussion about not knowing exactly what the reporting requirements would be, but that it did not appear that there would be any impact to CGIP, and that if it was, it would be a minor impact that would be spread across agencies.
Representative Brinley.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do think that that's important for us to know in this committee if there will be an impact in CGIP, because certainly while that might not affect the general fund, certainly that would affect payers throughout the system. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schultz, you put your hand up. Do you want to answer?
Yes, Chair Nelson. I will just read the quote from the fiscal note. It says, quote, CGIP does not anticipate additional administrative fees from its health fund administrators to provide this new value-based reporting to MDH. But CGIP anticipates no fiscal impact. That's what the quote says from this bill.
We will watch it when it finally gets to us. Representative Elkins, you had a...
Yeah, just a follow-up. So my guess is that the reason that there is no fiscal impact on CGIP is that CGIP probably isn't doing this, but CGIP probably should be doing this. And so if, you know, by passing this bill and obtaining the information about, how the degree to which the payers that are doing this are benefiting, both in terms of cost and improved patient outcomes, it would give us the information that we would need in order to direct CGIP to do something like this in order to improve patient outcomes and reduce costs.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Nash, your hand is up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will just say I think that holding this in the possession of the committee until we have a full understanding of the fiscal ramifications is probably the most prudent thing. Even if the author doesn't want it to be that way and others would like it to be expediently moved out of committee based on not complete information, I think that's a really poor decision. And I think that holding it in committee, Mr. Chair, is exactly the right decision. Thank you.
And Representative Nash, it's scary, but I think you and I are sharing the same thought, and that may scare a lot of people. Representative Druskowski.
May I respond to that, Chair Nelson?
Representative Schultz, you want to respond?
Thank you.
Quickly.
So, Representative Nash, they will not have the information to produce a fiscal note. They're predicting that there will be no cost to CGIP. If there is a cost, it'll be by their health plan administrators,
where they're and they don't believe they're going to pass on, they'll be very small fee potentially that would be spread across premiums. And so we can't wait for additional information because it's never going to come. So there's not going to be a time where we're going to get the fuller picture in a different fiscal note.
Representative Schultz, that's when we get the bill, we'll have more information. Maybe by that time, or we can have more definition of that. Representative Drazkowski, and then we're going to lay this over, and because we don't have it in our possession, so we can't vote it out. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if Ms. Roberts would enlighten us on the CGIP fund. It seems to me that if there is a cost to CGIP, it will accrue to a cost to departments throughout government that have to pay the government share into that. Is that how that works, Ms. Roberts?
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, you're correct that the CGIP fund is funded through both employer and employee premiums to pay for insurance claims. I would, again, point you to the fiscal note that I think one of the issues here, as Representative Schultz said, is that at this point, the implementation of this bill and the reporting requirements are far enough in the future that the CGIP administration doesn't know what that impact would be, but that they anticipate that it would not be major and then would not have a, you know, it would be, as I said, spread across all agencies, so wouldn't have a significant impact to any particular agency. But your underlying description of how it works is correct.
Representative Drazkowski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just the point I wanted to make is that it would have a general fund impact. It might not be reflected in our fiscal note process, but it certainly would affect the general fund if indeed there is an impact to CGIP. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Drazkowski, it might be such a thing as that it's, as this happens at times, it's something that the agencies will absorb. With that, members, I think we've spent enough time on this. It'll be coming back up to us when we have to vote it out of committee. So I'm going to lay this over. Thank you, Representative Schultz, for your time. And I apologize that the mechanisms of the government and the getting it engrossed and getting to us, it didn't happen in a timely fashion. With that, members, the next bill we had was Representative Zhang's bill. And Representative Zhang is presenting two other bills in other committees. And members, that's something that happens this time of year and actually all through the session, that members have multiple bills up on the same time. So members, I'm going to suggest that we take a 10-minute break here. And just so you know, my understanding is the recording continues while we're on break. So I know sometimes when we're in person on break, they shut the tape down and stuff gets set off offline that shouldn't be heard in the public. So just for members, I've got 9:38 here now. Why don't we come back at 10 minutes to 10 and on our 9:50, and so the 12-minute break. And Representative Quam, you got a question?
I was just suggesting we could do the Nash bill since the author's present.
Well, there's another bill, but yes, we've got two other bills, but I think it's appropriate time for a break, and the chair might need to use a facilities. So it might be time for everyone to be able to take a break and do that. We'll come back at 10 minutes to 10. So members, we are on recess to order. And I understand Representative Zhang is back with us, and I hope your two bills and your other committee went well. Representative Zhang, I will move. Get it to right here. I will move House File 3237 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Zhang, you want to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe I have a DE1 amendment.
I see that here now. Yes, Representative Zhang, I'll move the DE1 amendment to put the bill in the form that the author would like. Representative Zhang, you want to explain your amendment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment came to me after having conversation with our trades folks on our clarifications of the phrase goods and services, including construction. So we opted to take out those changes out to keep that portion of the language as current law.
Members, any questions? If not, otherwise, if everybody wants to unmute, we will move the amendment to put the bill, the DE amendment to put the bill in the form the author would like. All in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Ayes have it. The amendment's adopted. So Representative Zhang, you want to explain what the bill does?
Thank you, Chair Nelson and members. House File 3237 is an admin's bill for small business program enhancements and state contracting clarification. It's an effort to increase state contracts with targeted groups, economic disadvantage, and veteran-owned small businesses. To do this, the administration recommends expanding their small business program, increasing the preference that targeted groups, economically disadvantaged and veteran-owned small businesses receive a competitive bidding process, streamlining the certification process, consistently applying subcontractor goals to all prime contractors, as well as some state contracting statute clarifications. Contracts with the state of Minnesota can help targeted group economically disadvantaged and veteran-owned small businesses thrive and positively impact our state. The admin's contracting proposals are an effort in increasing the use of the agency's small business program and improving the likelihood that a targeted group economically disadvantaged and veteran-owned small business will earn a state contract. You all should have received some documents from the State Department of Admin, which shows many great needs, how this bill will benefit a lot of our communities in greater Minnesota. And I have a few folks here today, including the commissioner, to testify on this bill.
And it's my notes. Commissioner Roberts Davis has got a conflict at this time, but we have Ms. Betsy Hayes here, the Chief Procurement Officer for the Department of Admin. And I see Ms. Byerly here if to answer questions. But Ms. Betsy Hayes, if you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Hayes. I'm the Chief Procurement Officer with the Department of Administration's Office of State Procurement. I want to thank, first of all, Representative Zhang for authoring our bill today, which is Admin Small Business Program Enhancements and State Contracting Clarifications Bill. This bill, in short, will enhance our small business program. It's going to help grow our pool of vendors that do business with the state, and it adds some clarifications to our procurement language. Throughout my testimony today, I'll be using the acronym TGEDVO, and that means that stands for a business that has been certified as part of our targeted group program, economically disadvantaged is one of our 44 businesses from our 44 economically disadvantaged counties, and includes businesses owned by veterans as well. Now to the bill itself. First, we want to make sure in the bill that we have consistency with language surrounding the authority for subcontractor goals. Currently, the law authorizes the state to require a prime contractor to subcontract a portion of the contract to TGEDVO vendors. However, those requirements do not apply to prime contractors who are themselves TGEDVO small businesses. So our bill changes that to make the requirements the same for all of the prime contractors, regardless of their status. This will even the playing field for all prime contractors. Admin is also proposing a clarification to the prohibition of the best and final offer negotiation technique. This change makes it clear that using best and final offers for building construction contracts is prohibited when using the low bid technique, but is not prohibited under a best value process. The ability to negotiate proposals is important, is an important component of any best value procurement process. So this change in statute makes it clear that the prohibition on using the best and final offers applies only to low bid processes and not the best value process. Next, we'd like to expand our small business program. The current program streamlines the procurement process for purchases under $25,000 when made from a TGED or VO business. It has been a really successful tool to increase the contracting opportunities with certified small businesses. Admin is proposing to increase the $25,000 threshold to $100,000. This would expand the program, give more flexibility to agencies, and help spread the state's procurement dollars to more businesses. In addition to expanding our small business program, we are proposing to increase the percentage of preference that a certified TGED VO business receives in a competitive bidding process from 6% to 12%. Admin conducted an internal analysis on contracts and found that this increase would help us to continue to vary the state spend on contracting. And our last item focuses on EDVO businesses. It's our proposal to streamline the certification process. We would like to do this by recognizing certifications that small businesses have received from nationally recognized certifying organizations as part of their state certification. The requirements would need to be substantially the same as those adopted in Minnesota and approved by admin. So we would maintain our strong controls to ensure that there's not fraud in the program, but be able to recognize the efforts of the businesses to achieve these national certifications as part of their state certification. And then finally, we have a report cleanup. There is a reference to admin having to do reports to the legislature in 2013 and 2014. Those reports were completed, and the requirement did not have recurring annual reports, so we're looking to delete this obsolete language. So with that, I want to thank you for your time this morning. I'm happy to stand for any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Hayes. Members, any questions? Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author or testifier, can you give me a consistent and reliable definition of an economically disadvantaged area, because I'm trying to figure out, we heard that this is available in, I think, 44 counties, but we've got 87, and I just wanted to understand what the parameters of an economically disadvantaged area is, and I'll have other questions, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Hayes.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, economically disadvantaged businesses are defined by federal requirements, and I believe in your handouts today, we have provided a map that highlights which of those counties within Minnesota are deemed by those definitions economically disadvantaged. So if you did not receive those handouts, I would be happy to follow up and get that to you, which shows you very specifically which counties they are. It's largely outstate counties.
And members, it is in our map. There's a map of that. The ones in green, if you pull the map up, it's a lot of outstate rural counties, Cooch, Kitson, Marshall, Red Lake County, Cook County, Becker, Otter Tail. Like I said, mostly outstate counties that are listed in green that would be considered disadvantaged counties. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I guess I'm just trying to ascertain if that's been updated relative to some of the recent happenings, but I wanted to address the increase in the threshold. You know, I have been an advocate for transparency, good government, and accountability, and I just, members, I can't support this. I don't support the fact that we are now elevating the level 200,000. I like scrutiny. I like details. I like the ability to track money as it not just drips out of state government, but it gushes out of state government. And I just find that while the expediency around elevating a level seems nice, I also think of the perspective of the taxpayer who is looking at this and saying, well, I would like to know where my tax dollars are going. And I just think we should keep the granularity that is currently in statute and not elevate the level to 100,000. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Any further questions? Ms. Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that comment, Representative Nash, I just wanted to share that the increase, for example, from the 25 to 100,000, it is a level that's consistent with some other authorities, for example, that local units have. They have, in fact, up to 175,000, where they can they have an expedited process to procure, and that the transparency with respect to those procurements would remain the same, still subject to the same data practices provisions, and in fact, being able to go direct to a certified targeted group business does save in a lot of the soft costs associated with the work and the administrative procedures that the procurement officials need to do. So in fact, there's some efficiencies gained by increasing that threshold.
Representative Nash, did you put your hand back up? Looks like it went
down.
Yes,
Mr. Chair, just very, very quickly. So would that then be predicated on having to submit a FOIA request to get that data? Because I will tell you, having done that, it takes forever. So perhaps the transparency may not be as transparent as one might hope. I find that getting a FOIA request or a data request out of any state agency to be very cumbersome, time-consuming, and frustrating as hell. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Zhang, for bringing this bill forward. I can tell you, when I've talked to a lot of business owners, particularly that would fit this smaller category, that this is something they've been asking for, candidly, to be given more opportunity. And this bill gives them a little bit more flexibility and a little bit more opportunity. And so it really is a great bill in terms of being able to allow more of these businesses to get a foothold in the door and really make a difference in building their business. So thank you for that, and I appreciate the bill.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Seeing no further hands, Representative Zhang, you want to wrap up your bill, and then we'll lay this over for inclusion.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and members of the committee. This bill, again, is really for supporting our small businesses and veteran-owned businesses. I want to reiterate that. Small businesses and veteran-owned businesses in greater Minnesota, folks. For those of you who keep saying, oh, we're too metro-based, well, this is your opportunity to support legislation that will benefit those in greater Minnesota who have been, if you look at the map, deemed as economically disadvantaged. This is to help them. I appreciate your support, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Zhang. And with that, members, we'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion. Members, the next bill on the agenda is House File 3986, and it's a Nelson M. bill. I don't know who that guy is, but I will hand the gavel over to Representative Carlson, Vice Chair Carlson, and take it from there.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Would you like to move your bill, House File 3986?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will move House File 3986. And again, this is going to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Wonderful. Chair Nelson, would you like to proceed with some information regarding your bill?
And members, this is the bill that came out of the Barbers Council. This is just an update of their statute, some minor changes. One major change is having to do with the appointment of members to the Barbers Examiners Board. Or the Board of Barber Examiners. Currently, there's a position that requires that the Union of Journeymen Barbers appoint one person to the board. Currently, there is no longer a statewide Union of Journeymen Barbers, and so therefore, they're striking that to allow, update the statute. There's some fees here. They're putting in the, there's been a request and talk for the last few years, and the Barbers Examiners Board has gone through this about mobile barbershops, and there's been a desire for some people to create mobile barbershops. That's probably the meat of the bill, is the language around creating that mobile barbershop, the regulations around that, the fees around that, similar to the fees that would be for a regular barbershop. There's also in here a piece about allowing, there's been some questions or requests for cosmetologists who wish to become barbers, and the way it currently is under statute, they have to start from the beginning and go all the way through. This is giving them some credit for their times and their work getting a cosmetology license towards getting their barber license and switching over to becoming a barber as opposed to a cosmetologist. There's some changes that are here on the examination schedule. Current statute says they have to do it six times a year, or not. They're six times a year. Now it says they have to do it at least four times a year. I think it was before not more than six times a year. That's basically it. What the bill does is basically an update of the statute for the Barbers Examination Board. And with that, members, I'll take questions. And we have a Mr. Testifier here, Mr. Brent Gribanowski from the Mr. Chair.
Great. Well, thank you, Chair Nelson. Appreciate your opening comments. We do have a testifier, Mr. Brett Gribanowski. Mr. Gribanowski, I hope I'm pronouncing your last name correctly. Would you like to proceed with your testimony?
Thank you. My name is Brent Gribanowski. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Barber Examiners, and I would like to thank you for the opportunity to let me present House File 3986 today. Representative Nelson has gone over many of the things I'm already going to talk about, so I'll just touch on them briefly. This bill addresses five major things in barber rule and statute. The first two are recommendations from the Office of the Legislative Auditor regarding cosmetology reciprocity. This bill would establish a process where licensed cosmetologists can be credited with up to 1,000 hours of their training and study toward becoming a barber through reciprocity. Secondly, this bill looks to better define the differences between barbering and cosmetology. It defines straight razor shaving as being a barber service, and it defines the procedure of waxing and explains that it is not in the scope of practice for a barber. This bill also addresses registered barber examinations. It removes some onerous requirements for barber students who fail examinations. Right now, if you fail the barber examination, you have to go back to school for 500 hours. We want to eliminate that. It provides the board with additional flexibility in offering more frequent examinations to get barber students working in their chosen field more quickly. This bill also establishes definitions, fees, and provisions for mobile barbershops, which would allow barbers to safely practice their trade outside of a barbershop, and would allow barbers to reach customers who may be homebound or who may simply lack a brick and mortar barbershop in their community. And lastly, this bill eliminates requirements for board member appointments that are outdated. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'll make myself available.
Thank you, Mr. Rabinowski, for your testimony. I do see we have no further testifiers, so we'll move on to member questions. Representative Mason, I see you've got your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one disclaimer, I do have a bill that's updating cosmetology, but in doing that, because now I am seeing, in particular, many young men that are getting their hair colored, et cetera, and I haven't done a survey, so I don't know whether they're getting this done in regular salons or whether they're doing it in barbershops. But to me, there seems to be a blurring here. So the intent of this bill just to try and establish firmer boundaries, so to speak?
Mr. Grabanowski.
Yes, Representative Mason. That's exactly what this bill is trying to do, is trying to better define some of the like you said, the blurring of the lines between barbering and cosmetology, specifically with straight razor shaving, because barbers traditionally consider that to be a barber service. And there was some confusion in the OLA report whether or not barbers were allowed to do waxing. So we wanted to better define that that is not a barber service. Barbers are allowed to do colors, just like cosmetologists are. So there is some overlap between what the two different professions can do. But yes, our intent is to try to better define the two different industries.
So is there much difference
Representative Mason.
Is there much difference between what it takes to do the hair coloring for cosmetology versus a barber?
Mr. Grabanowski.
There's no, the way you do colors in both are the same. The procedures are the same in both.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Members, we're going to pause here for a second. I've been informed that we have an amendment. This will be an oral amendment. For explanation, I'm going to hand it over to Mr. Gearing. If you could please provide an explanation to the amendment. Mr. Gearing.
My colleague Anna Scholein is on the call, and she drafted the amendment, so I might defer to her to walk through what it is.
Okay, I'm sorry. Can you repeat who will be explaining the amendment again?
Anna Scholein, Ms. Scholein, also from House Research.
Ms. Scholein, okay. Ms. Scholein, if you could please explain the amendment.
Chair and members, we have a paper version of the amendment. Did that just not meet the deadline?
I'm informed that this seems pretty simple, that we could just do this as an oral amendment.
Okay.
But if there could be some brief explanation so that the members have a clear understanding of what they're voting on.
Would this be the page 12, line 9, after hours, insert of study, which in the discretion of the board has curriculum requirements that are equivalent to the requirements in section 154.07. And so this would just be saying that the hours the cosmetologists are getting credit for towards their barber hours requirement would need to be ones that the barber board agreed are covering the same sort of material, such as hair coloring, which would be the same in both sets of courses.
Okay. I'm sorry,
that's Representative Nash.
I've got multiple screens going on here. Representative Nash, do you have a question?
Yeah. To the chair regarding the oral amendment, did the written amendment not get submitted in time, or?
Yeah. Kind of looking for clarification.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
Mr. Chair.
Chair Nelson.
This is my first knowledge of the amendment. I never got it. Our staff never got it, but we're laying this over. So when we bring this back up we could put the amendment on when we put this in an omnibus bill, if we have the omnibus bill. So I think that would be the better way to go about it, but it's the first I've seen the amendment, and but it sounds like it's a pretty simple amendment.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, and to Representative Nelson, so I gather this is not your amendment. Do we know who is offering this amendment?
I think Mr. Grabanowski has an answer to that.
Or maybe not.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was waiting for you to give me permission.
Yes,
to speak.
I'm sorry. Mr. Grabanowski, can you provide some clarity with regards to the amendment,
please? Sure. The amendment was made to the cosmetology reciprocity portion of the bill. When the bill was jacketed by the revisor's office, they They did a great job taking our language and changing it for clarity and to conform with their standards. However, I missed an omission in their draft. And what it would do would be allow the board to look and see what the education of a cosmetologist is who is applying for reciprocity and comparing that to what barbers are required to have here in Minnesota so that we could give credit for their education. Right now, the way the bill was written would automatically give someone 1,000 hours if they were licensed from any state or country. So technically, a person from another country could have a 200-hour class and have a license in their country, and we'd have to give them credit for 1,000 hours. So that's what the amendment is about.
Okay. Chair Nelson, this sounds like more than what we can do with an oral amendment. So to your point in regards to incorporating this at a later time, since this bill will be laid over, is that the course of action you wish to proceed with?
Mr. Chair, yeah, I think that would be better because I haven't seen the amendment before, and it seems like it's relatively straightforward, but we'll be taking this up later when and if we put it into an omnibus bill. And so we can do it at that time. I think that would be better for the committee and everybody.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you, Chair Nelson. And Mr. Grebanowski, thank you for the explanation there. Members, so we're gonna keep our comments to the bill before us. There is no further testifiers. Member questions? Any member questions? I'm not seeing any hands up. Okay, Chair Nelson, closing comments to your bill.
As I said in my opening comments, this is just an update of the Barber Examiner Board statute and or the Board of Barber Examiner statute and just modernizing it and dealing with some things from the OLA report that came out on cosmetologists. So members, that's what the bill does.
Okay. Chair Nelson, would like for House File 3986 be laid over for possible inclusion. With that, the bill has been laid over. I'll turn the gavel back over to Chair Nelson.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Carlson. The next bill we have on our agenda is House File 2747, Representative Claiborne. And there, Representative Claiborne, if you want to make your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 2747 be moved to the General Register.
And I see there's a couple of amendments. Which one is yours?
Mine is the A1. Thank you.
The A1 amendment. Do you want to move your amendment and explain what the amendment does?
I move the A1, and because of the detail of the A1, it looks very simple, but I would like to ask Mr. Gehring if he would explain the need for this amendment and the narrowing that this amendment does for us. Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Gehring, if you want to explain what this amendment does.
Mr. Chair, Matt Gehring from House Research. So lines 1.2 and 1.3 narrow the scope of how this bill would apply so that it doesn't apply to public officials, but instead applies to candidates for elected office. So Representative Claiborne could probably describe sort of the general intent of the bill, but this is targeting receipts of contributions that are made by lobbyists for access to certain spaces, and instead of sort of restricting access to spaces where public officials might sort of congregate, this is limited more towards spaces where candidates for elected office would congregate. So that's what you see on lines 1.2, 1.3 of the amendment. Line 1.4 of the amendment is getting rid of the word primary, and that I don't remember where that fits in the bill.
Mr. Gehring, I think the fact that public officials is so broad, that's the piece I was concerned about.
Mr. Chair, Representative Claiborne, the remainder of the amendment I would describe as roughly technical cleanup language, just to make sure that we're using the terms as they're used in Chapter 10A and talking about which types of groups are subject to this restriction, how we're describing the way that these groups would provide access to public to candidates for office.
So members, that's the A1 amendment. It's to put the bill in the order that the author wishes. All, if you want to unmute, all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. And Representative Claiborne, is the A2 amendment yours, or is that?
The A2 amendment is not mine.
Well, then, Representative Claiborne, if you want to describe your bill, and then
Mr.
we will.
The A2 is mine.
Okay. Then Representative Nash will let Representative Claiborne explain her bill, and then we can take up the A2 amendment. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you. Chair Nelson and members, House Bill 27, well, I'll just start it this way. House Bill 2747 is really a ban on pay-to-play contributions to gain access to legislators. Voters have an innate belief that certain people have more privileged access and that government only answers to those who pay for it. Permitting social access clubs would confirm those beliefs. House File 2747 is a ban on pay-to-play contributions to gain access to legislators during the regular legislative or special legislative sessions. Where did this bill come from? The Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board issued an advisory opinion, 454, on October 6th of 2021. Mr. Ricardo Lopez reported on this advisory opinion in the Minnesota Reformer on November 12th of 2021. His article, Senate GOP gets okay to create private club for legislators, lobbyists during the special session, brought my attention to the matter and the rules around forming special access clubs and the issue of transparency and undue influence. Mr. Lopez also reported that the Senate GOP's campaign committee, the Senate Victory Fund, confirmed that they had requested the opinion. The existing campaign finance statutes make it permissible for a legislative caucus to set up a space where lobbyists and other political groups and associations would be required to pay a membership fee in order to meet with legislators of that caucus. This bill closes the gap in our statutes. So here's what the bill does. The bill expands the existing prohibition on campaign contributions during a legislative session to prohibit at any time of the year certain contributions by a registered lobbyist, political committee, political fund, or other association if, this is an important if, in exchange for the contribution, a registered lobbyist or other individual is granted special access to a meeting room, a hospitality area, or event space where public officials are likely to gather. And the primary purpose of granting that access is to facilitate informal meetings or socialization with public officials during the regular or special sessions of the legislature. With me today to talk to this, the importance of this bill, and I don't know if Chair Nelson, you have Judge Beck, or if you have Miss Belladonna on the testifier list first, but they are here to speak to the bill, and I would ask that you please go to them.
And Representative Claiborne, I have Mr. Beck, I have Miss Belladonna Correa, and I have Mr. Sigurdsson if needed to answer questions. And why don't we first take care of the A2 amendment, Representative Nash. I will understand that's your amendment.
It is, Mr. Chair. I would move the A2 and request a roll call.
Representative Nash moves the A2 amendment and requests a roll call. Representative Nash, what does your amendment do?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, we've talked a lot about transparency and accountability. And during the peacetime emergency, we saw a number of things happening at the legislature that were behind closed doors. There were things that were not available to the public. We had members of the public that would try to testify on bills that were being presented in committee that were on Zoom meetings. So in the vein that Representative Claiborne is saying that she would like to make sure that transparency is paramount, that is the gist of my amendment, that no vote can be cast by the legislature during any time if the public is not able to observe the legislation in person. So I thank you for your support and renew my motion for the roll call.
And Representative Claiborne, it's your bill. What is your
thank you.
What do you feel about the amendment? Yes.
I really appreciate the amendment, and I appreciate the intent behind Representative Nash's amendment. Unfortunately, our Capitol building was built long ago, and it has a very small gallery space. If there were a member of the public who wanted to attend and could not fit into that gallery space safely, we would not be able to take votes on the floor of the House. Further, I spoke to Capitol Security about whether or not this would be feasible, and I was told that there could be times when there would be a legitimate threat and we would need to close the gallery, and that under our current situation, members of the public are able to view what is happening through technology in the Capitol at all times whenever we are in session. So that it was believed that this particular amendment was not necessary for the public to be able to be fully informed. Therefore, I am requesting a no vote. Well, there's one other piece. I want to make sure that the bill that I bring forward is very clear, and it's in Chapter 10. And the amendment that Representative Nash is bringing forward is in Chapter 3. So I want to keep this bill clean to Chapter 10. So thank you very much.
And I urge a no vote. Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will just point out that it is not just floor votes. It is committee votes. Committee votes is where so many people were actually turned away by DFL committee administrators and chairs. They were not allowed to testify. They were not allowed to weigh in on things. They were not allowed to do anything. A number of people have made that very, very clear on social media and to me personally. And Representative Claiborne, I serve on Capitol Area Security, and I know this very well. There has not been an expressed overriding issue with having people in public in the Capitol. The Capitol, as you pointed out, was built to receive people. It is the people's home. It is the people's house. And while I appreciate the effort of your bill, I will point out that the DFL has gone to extraordinary lengths to keep people out of the public and keep them out of places where votes are being cast. So a no vote for this is a vote against public interaction and against transparency. Thank you.
Mr. Chair Nelson, may I respond, please?
Representative Claiborne, quickly.
Thank you. I'll keep my comments very short. I will just like to remind the committee that I have spoken to Capitol Security, the people who are responsible for making sure that both the public and the legislative body are safe. And they told me that there are legitimate reasons for not accepting this amendment. And with that, I will ask for a no vote. Thank you.
With that, members, Representative Nash has moved the A2 amendment on the request of the roll call. Mr. Brinks, we want to take the roll.
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
No.
Nelson votes nay. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson, no.
Carlson votes nay. Representative Nash.
Yes.
Nash votes aye. Representative Bonner.
No.
Bonner votes nay. Representative Drazkowski.
Aye.
Drazkowski votes aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins votes no.
Elkins votes nay. Representative Greenman.
No.
Greenman votes no. Representative Claiborne.
Claiborne votes no.
Claiborne votes no. Representative Kosnick.
Yes.
Kosnick votes aye. Representative Mason.
Mason, no.
Mason votes nay. Representative New Brindley.
Yes.
New Brindley votes aye. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski, no.
Pawlowski votes nay. Representative Quam.
With the voice of my constituents, I vote yes.
Quam votes aye. Chair, with a vote of five ayes and eight nays, the motion does not prevail.
The motion does not prevail.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Claiborne, we'll get on to our testifiers.
I'd like to just reground us on the subject matter of the bill, since that took us down a little bit of a different path. The subject matter of the bill is a ban on pay-to-play contributions. And with that, I ask that we go to our testifier.
Thank you, Representative Claiborne. The first person on my list is George Beck. Mr. Beck, if you want to introduce yourself for the record, and please begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is George Beck. I'm on the board of Clean Elections Minnesota. Last year, the Senate Victory Fund sought and received the approval of the Campaign Finance Board to create a loophole around the law prohibiting campaign contributions during the legislative session. The fund proposed to create what amounts to a private club during the session for its legislators, and then invited lobbyists and others seeking legislators' time and favors. The general public was not welcome. The club would be supported by contributions from lobbyists made prior to the session. Access would then be provided during the session based on those pre-session payments. The board unfortunately decided that this did not violate the no contributions during the session law. But in fact, it created a special opportunity for lobbyists and their clients who had circumvented state law by prepaying for the exclusive privilege to lobby elected officials while the legislature was in session. This undemocratic special interest plan at least violates the spirit of state law and needs to be clearly outlawed. House File 2747 specifically prohibits contributions from lobbyists at any time of the year, which is used to provide special access to a meeting with legislators during a regular or special session. To his credit, Senate Majority Leader Jeremy Miller has recently been quoted as saying that he has no plans to hold such an event. I think, therefore, this bill should have bipartisan support, and we hope it receives unanimous support from this committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Beck. The next person I have on my list is Anastasia Belladonna Correa. And I hope I said that properly. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For those of you that I haven't had the pleasure of meeting yet, my name is Anastasia Belladonna Carrera, and I'm the Executive Director for Common Cause Minnesota. I'm here on behalf of over 18,000 multi-partisan statewide members and supporters. And despite belonging to various affiliations, some not even affiliated, the whole thing that brings everyone together in supporting our work is ensuring that our republic's democracy is safeguarded, our elections continue to reflect the will of Minnesotans, and that everyone's vote counts. We are concerned about the increased lack of access to the state legislature and lawmakers for constituents, particularly these last 2 years being the period when we received the most statewide complaints from constituents. Public conference committees appear to become a thing of the past. Negotiations have moved behind closed doors, shutting the public out and making it virtually impossible for constituents to, most importantly, be aware of how things are happening and hold members accountable. The bill will prevent, this particular bill will prevent yet another advantage to capital insiders. Representative Cleveland already made reference to the advisory opinion, as did Judge Beck, or Mr. Beck, with regards to the campaign finance board related to this issue. Common Cause Minnesota took issue as well with regards to that position. We do not agree with it for the reasons that Mr. Beck already cited. We're relieved when Senator Miller spoke unfavorably to this idea and are grateful that Representative Cleaver took action to prevent these types of insider clubs from becoming a common occurrence in Minnesota. Our position is that any time a member of the legislature finds themselves with extra time, that should be spent within their districts, directly engaging with all of their constituents, learning more about how issues impact every corner of their district and not behind closed doors of any type of insider club between lobbyists and electives. This bill addresses the need to prevent pay-to-play lobbyist clubs granting special interest groups access to key decision makers while keeping constituents and the public and other community stakeholders out. Common Cause and our members are opposed to any idea that creates an unequal access for Minnesota constituents at the Capitol to their legislators, and in any other space, actually. This is why we support the bill before us. We thank Representative Cleaver for bringing this important bill forward. We're especially appreciative that it's a common sense bill written within a narrow scope and based on an issue that merits bipartisan support. Please put constituents first by supporting House File 2747. And Representative Nash, I would love to work with you and revisit the increasing access and transparency that I saw in the spirit of your bill, because we too received similar complaints about some of the things that you highlight. So I'd love to connect with you later. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for your time and hard work.
And with that, again, Mr. Sigurdsson's here to answer questions as needed. Ms. Representative New Brindley, I see you have your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Representative Cleaborn, I certainly like the spirit of this bill. I think the whole issue was silly. However, I do have a question. I mean, first of all, I think that there is some gray area that every single legislator participates in. That, and I don't mean gray area in that it's nefarious, I mean gray area as it relates to this bill. So for example, every caucus holds caucus fundraisers where donations are required to participate in the fundraiser. The Democrat House caucus does it, the Republican House caucus does it, both the Senate caucuses do it, we all hold fundraisers. And where I am concerned is that is this idea on lines 2.5 and 2.6, the primary purpose of granting special access is to facilitate informal meetings or socialization with public officials during a regular or special session of the legislature. I mean, is there a reason that we couldn't assume that a fundraiser would be for the purpose of facilitating informal meetings or socialization? What is to prevent that interpretation of this bill?
Representative Claiborne.
I will ask Mr. Sigurdsson to help with this clarification, please.
Mr. Sigurdsson, please identify yourself for the record and give us your answer.
Good morning, Chair, committee members. My name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Recall that this is amending a statute that prohibits contributions during the legislative session. So while the caucuses may have fundraisers, they cannot have fundraisers during the regular legislative session. So that isn't affected by this particular provision. Fundraisers outside of legislative session, of course, could still occur. But even under current statute, you would not be able to have a fundraiser by the caucus during the legislative session.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I totally understand that. And thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson, for that. I certainly understand the current provisions and current law. My concern is adding 2.5 and 2.6. I think that is the purpose of those meetings, is to provide informal meetings and socialization with public officials. And that carries through to being in session. And frankly, line 2.7 says special access means privileges to enter and use a space that is not freely available to members of the public. Would that include my office? That's to Representative Cleaborn, the author of the bill. What's the intent there? Would that include my office? That's the space that's not freely available to the public.
As a state office
Representative Cleaborn, Representative Cleaborn.
Excuse me.
Go through the chair, remember. We have to go through the chair.
Apologize, Chair Nelson. To answer the question, Chair Nelson, I would say that we do not charge anyone a fee to enter your office.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of course we don't. Like, that's absurd. But the point is that this is not about anyone. This is specifically about lobbyist access. And while certainly, like I said, in theory, I am supportive of this bill, and I will likely vote for the bill, because like I said, I think the issue was silly. I'm concerned about the language here, that this could at some point be considered. I mean, like I said, we all participate in fundraisers. We all participate in fundraisers that don't happen during session, but could be construed to offer influence during session or access during session. Frankly, this idea of creating special access to lobbyists and their clients, I appreciate Ms. Belladonna Carrera's testimony. And frankly, we've had many conversations. I could be wrong, Anastasia, and I apologize if I am, but I don't know that we have ever talked to any fundraiser, but my office is always open to, frankly, lobbyists and their clients are also known as our constituents most of the time. Their clients are known as our constituents. I get it. This is a good political stab at the Senate Republicans. And again, I agree that the whole concept was silly. But I think there are concerns with the language. I'm going to vote for it, but be aware moving forward that there are real concerns with this language. And I think that you might want to clean that up a little bit before voting for this off the House floor.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Brindley. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you very much, Representative New Brindley. And certainly I would be happy to work with you going forward on any bill that you think would clean up campaign finance. I think that's a really great idea. And frankly, if it were up to me, I would have no money in our public campaigns at all. But and they would be publicly sponsored, but that's a different bill on a different day. When you look at this bill, I just want to make sure that we're all very clear. It's very narrow. And I am sure that you are not saying that you have ever taken a campaign contribution that would cause you to give that constituent a special. That is not what I thought I heard, what I thought you were saying. And certainly I wouldn't want you to imply that I would ever take a contribution that would gain some special privilege for any voter or member of the lobbying community. And I want to be very, very clear. This is not an anti-lobbying bill. Lobbying serves a very important purpose at the Capitol, and it can improve government. So I don't want to anyone to construe that this is a bill against our lobbyists.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Claiborne, what you're saying is exactly the opposite. The point is, my door is always open to lobbyists or anyone else. Now, we hear a very different story about our Democrat friends in the House from the lobbying community. They have almost no access. But my door is almost always open. And again, because lobbyists, you call them clients, I call them constituents, actually. Lobbyists and their clients, my constituents. That's exactly the point. I think this language is not quite as narrow as you think it is, and that's the problem. Again, we all participate, all of our caucuses participate in fundraisers that could be construed then to provide access. Those fundraisers do not happen during the legislative session. That is very clearly defined in law. But when you include lines 2.5 and 2.6, that the primary purpose of granting the special access is to facilitate informal meetings or socialization, I mean, the granting special access, well, it's just a fundraiser. If you're coming to the event, you're paying money to attend an event. Like, the language in here is gray. I understand that you believe it's very narrow, but it's not. It's not. And again, I would question what that means. Privileges to enter and use that space is not freely available to members of the public. Am I going to get dinged that I participated in a fundraiser and then later on that lobbyist is invited into my office for a meeting? Now, I understand that everyone on the call is saying, no, that wouldn't possibly happen. That's what the words in the bill could allow for. And that's my concern. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's your concern. Representative Nash, you have your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was going to make some of the same points that Representative New Brindley did, but I'll just point out that if you follow me on social media, you know that I have had office hours in the rotunda of the Capitol. And yeah, I have gone to extraordinary and some might say stunt-oriented lengths to meet with constituents, meet with lobbyists, meet with anybody who wants to show up. I actually had what I call a couple of pickup meetings of people who were just wandering by, and they said, what an amazing thing that somebody would go to the trouble of making themselves available when the state office building is closed during this time. And I would say we are well past the time that it should be closed. And I will say I'm disappointed that we didn't take the A2 amendment, because it is very much oriented in the spirit of transparency. I will tell you, many of my constituents feel that they have been deprived of access to legislators. They have been deprived of the ability to testify in committee. They have actually been kept out of testifying for committee. And I can go into a litany of examples. I won't now because I see the face of the chair, but I will be more than happy to talk about the times where people who wanted to testify have been turned away. So while I will vote for the bill, I find it to be somewhat hypocritical that we are not similarly addressing access of the public to places like Ms. Belladonna Carrera talked about conference committees not being open. And you all are in the majority. You all have gavels. You all decide who does and does not come in to conference committees when you have a gavel. And I think this is, let's face it, making fun of the Senate is always good fun, right? But this is not quite enough. And I feel that you are not addressing the actual needs that many Minnesotans are expressing, which is the denial of access to you. Again, I have a card table and a folding chair and a poster that looks just like the Peanuts cartoon that I set up in the rotunda. So don't tell me that we are not interested in transparency and availability. That may Representative Cleaborn, I'm not done yet. Thank you.
I'm happy Cleaborn, to
wait till you're recognized.
So I will tell you that I'll vote for this bill. I think the commentary from Representative New Brindley is absolutely germane to this bill and important. And I am just beyond frustrated because my constituents are frustrated. Your constituents are frustrated. I actually met in the rotunda with some of your constituents who were there trying to get access to you. And I will be honest, I told them, well, the decision of the majority in the House has been to not allow you access to the state office building. So I think this is an okay bill. It needs some tuning up, and I hope that Representative Cleaborn is true to her word, and she will work with whomever brings an amendment. But I think that this is not quite enough, and I just want to go on record as saying that.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Greenman, you have your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know, Representative Cleaborn had asked to speak, and I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't jumping in.
Representative Cleaborn, Representative Greenman, I've recognized you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Cleaborn, for bringing this bill. As you can tell, I have a little bit of a cold, so I'm going to keep it short, but I just, as somebody who served on the Campaign Finance Board and really appreciate the testimony of Judge Beck, because I think what this bill does is close a loophole. And just to reorient us, it really just does close a loophole to ensure that lobbyists, that there is not these special clubs and special access. And it's not a hypothetical, because we actually saw folks on the other side. It's not a joke or poking fun at the Senate. It is actually in response to what I would call an innovation to try to skirt campaign finance laws. But this is actually very much needed. It's unfortunate that it's needed because I agree that in the spirit of the campaign finance laws, this kind of behavior would be prohibited. But I think given that we need to respond to the to that innovation that we saw move forward. So I just really appreciate Representative Cleavorn, you doing the work with the and consulting the campaign finance board to make sure that this rule is tailored to reflect our current law and tailored to prevent this kind of access that I know that Minnesotans and constituents in my district care about. And it's great actually to hear on this committee that there's going to be bipartisan support, because I think we all agree and want to make sure that our constituents know that our door is open to Minnesotans. There is no special back room that comes. And so thank you again for bringing this bill.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Representative Drazkowski, you have your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cleavorn, thank you for the bill. I agree with the bill wholeheartedly. We have to continue to endeavor to do work in this area. Wherever there are decisions being made that affect people throughout Minnesota and there's money accumulating in order to try to come in and influence those decisions, there's going to be needs for us as a legislature to be as innovative, using Representative Greenman's word, and nimble as they are, because they will continue to try to do this. You know, I brought the amendment last session that started to work in this area. We need to do what you're doing here. I thank you for reaching out to me. I have read the language now in whole, and I'm going to sign on to your bill. I would also encourage you to entertain what Representative Nash was talking about. We need to make things more accessible around here. We're not done with this bill yet. Maybe we can have those discussions. Also, Representative Greenman and I are working on some work out of my lobbyist bill from a week or so ago, and we're going to be meeting with the campaign finance board, Mr. Sigurdsson, on that. I don't know if he knows that yet. We're hoping to. So there could be some other parts we could do, and I would ask you to entertain that as we go forward. But thank you for the bill, and let's make this a Minnesota where the people, the voters, are the ones that have the greatest influence on legislators, and not the high-paid lobbyists that roam the Capitol. And believe me, they're very capable people and they're paid very well. I do understand that. They're very good at what they do. We just want to make certain that the best access and the proper access is for our constituents, the people of Minnesota. So thank you, Representative Cleveland.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. And Representative Cleveland, if you want to wrap up and we'll get to a vote.
Well, I'm very pleased that the House is very clear that we should have free and accessible access to legislators so that all Minnesota's voices can be heard. I think that's a really great thing. And I just wanted to make sure that my colleagues on both sides of the table understand that my bringing this bill forward is in no way saying that they are not freely available to their constituents. I think the House is pretty good about making sure that we see our constituents, talk to our constituents, and are readily available to our constituents. I mean, we are the awesome House of Representatives. But what this bill does truly is closes a gap that we have found in our campaign finance law. And it says yes to Minnesotans that they deserve fair, open, and transparent rules around campaign finance. It says that access to legislators is not for sale. And it says that we should always keep Minnesotans in front and center of the work that we do. Members, I thank you for the support that you've expressed today, and I ask for your yes vote as we send this on to the General Register. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. And with that, Representative Cleavorn, you want to renew your motion?
I renew my motion that House File 2747 be moved to the General Register.
As amended.
as amended. Thank you.
Representative Claver renews her motion that House File 2747 as amended be referred to the General Register. Mr. Brinks, do you want to take the roll?
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson votes aye. Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Carlson votes aye. Representative Nash.
Aye.
Nash votes aye. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner votes aye. Representative Drazkowski.
Aye.
Drazkowski votes aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins votes aye.
Elkins votes aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman votes aye. Representative Cleburne.
Cleburne, aye.
Cleburne votes aye. Representative Kosnick.
Aye.
Kosnick votes aye. Representative Mason.
Mason, aye.
Mason votes aye. Representative New Brindley.
No.
New Brindley votes nay. Representative Pulowski is excused. Representative Quam.
No.
Quam votes nay. Chair, with a vote of 10 ayes, 2 nays, and 1 excuse, the motion prevails.
The motion prevails. The bill's on its way to the General Register. And members, the next bill and all we have on our agenda is Representative Nash's House File 2857. And Representative Nash, this is going to the General Register. Do you want to make your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 2857 be referred to the General Register, and I have two author's amendments I would like to engross.
Okay, Representative Nash. Representative Claiborne had an amendment. I think she just wants to talk about her amendment. And Representative Claiborne,
is it not customary that the author's amendments get taken up first?
Representative Claiborne,
I believe she wants to withdraw her amendment. Representative Claiborne.
That's correct, Chair Nelson. I spoke with Representative Nash yesterday, and his amendment and my amendment are very, very similar. I would just ask that we support this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Claiborne. Representative Nash, that's why I wanted to ask her first, talk to her first. Representative Nash, you've got the A1 and the A2 amendment, you said?
I have the A1 and the A4, Mr. Chair.
A1 and the A4. Representative Nash, you move your amendment and explain the A1 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair. This the A1 is a further clarification of what is sample ballot. That was in response to several of the conversations I had offline, both with you and other members who were interested in further clarifying that. It also deals with a lot of the criticism or concerns were. So, again, it's putting in language that would make it so that a reasonable person would not be able to mistake it as an official ballot.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Nash moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the way he wants it. If you want to unmute members, all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? A1 amendment's adopted. And the next is the A4 amendment. Representative Nash, do you want to move your amendment and explain it?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move the A4. And the A4, again, takes into consideration some of the commentary that I got from both members of the public and from some folks who really want to see this bill move forward. And it deletes one of the clauses, subdivision 2, that has been causing people issue. And we may work on that further. But so the A2 just tightens things up a little bit further in response to some of the outreach that I got.
Thank you, Representative Nash. And Representative Nash, I got some feedback about the bold letters that you want printed on there about font size. And in this case, size matters. If it's tiny font, no one's going to see it. No matter if it's in bold letters or not. But that's something we can work on further.
Yes, I did talk to a couple of different folks about the font size, and you know, we could talk about that and make sure that it is defined as something that is readable. I can bring that to the House floor as an author's amendment, but I did want to get this to the floor. And members, you will see in your packets that there's a letter that has been submitted in support of this. So would hope that we would be able to move that forward. So if I would be open to questions on the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Any questions on the amendment for members? Again, this is to put it in the shape that the author wants. Seeing no hands popping, Representative Greenman. I almost spoke too soon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Nash. And I just, for clarification, because I believe Representative Cleavorn and your amendments were pretty similar, and I wanted to make sure that I came with feedback from the Secretary of State.
Ms. Freeman, are you? I see you're on my screen. Ms. Freeman, you want to answer the question about the office? If you want to identify yourself for the record, please.
Sure. Nicole Freeman, Office of Secretary of State. We did provide feedback for the amendments. I didn't know if it was a question that Representative Freeman was asking or a statement she was making. But yes, our office did provide feedback on the amendments. And we are in support of the amendments. Yep.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that clarification. It wasn't clear from Representative Nash's statement about where the feedback came from. So I just wanted to make sure that, and I know that some of the concerns that we raised when we heard this bill a few weeks ago, especially about Subdivision 2, but also about some of the concerns about how you would execute the first one, were clarified in this amendment that both ended up in Representative Cleward and Representative Nash's amendment. And I just wanted to clarify that I think that a lot of that is coming from the folks who talk to the counties who will administer the elections. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Representative, if there's no further questions of the amendment, again, to put it in the shape the author wants, members, unmute your mics. All in favor of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. Representative Nash, you want to explain your bill? I think we heard this last a couple weeks ago, but he's just briefly explain your bill again.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the committee as a quick refresher and to the public watching. This bill would make it so that any organization, entity, or otherwise that is sending out a request for an absentee ballot, so that you get, many of us got them in the mail and many of our constituents got them and were very frustrated because they thought they were actual ballots. But this would require anybody sending out a ballot, an absentee ballot request form, print on the outer envelope, this is not an actual ballot and is not sent by a government entity and so on. So we have spoken about this. And Mr. Chair, there is a letter in the packet, as I had said, from the Association of Minnesota Counties and Minnesota Association of County Officers and the League of Minnesota Cities, all saying that they support this. And as Representative Greenman said, these are the people who are largely responsible for administering the elections in the localities that we all serve. So with that, I can stand for questions or we can move to a vote.
I see one hand up right now, Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the bill, Representative Nash. I really like the bill. I think it makes a great deal of sense, and I'm glad to see it moving forward and all the work you're doing on it. The one question I have is, so what? We do this and we put this in law. What are the consequences at that point for an organization or an individual that violates what you laid out here? Because they may not even read the law. They may just mail. So what are the consequences?
Representative Nash.
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I would actually ask Mr. Gehring, who helped me draft this, if he could address some of the penalty clauses or penalty situations, or perhaps Mr. Sigurdsson, if we could.
We'll start with Mr. Gehring. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Druskowski and Nash, Matt Gehring from House Research. This bill is proposing to code this prohibition in Chapter 211B, which is the Fair Campaign Practices Act. And as written, the remedy process would be an administrative process through the Office of Administrative Hearings. So they have the OAH has an existing sort of rubric that they use to determine penalties when they receive complaints about violations of the Fair Campaign Practices Act. And this would sort of fit within that rubric, depending on the severity of the violation and sort of history of the offender and that sort of thing. So there's not a specific penalty specified in the bill, but there's a process that the OAH uses to sort of impose penalties under current law.
Representative Druskowski.
Awesome. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That answers my question. We do have something, and we can always build on that. Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Thank you, Representative Nash and Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Any further questions? Seeing no hands jumping up on my screen and no one waving frantically in their video pictures. Representative Nash, do you want to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 2857 be referred to the General Register as amended.
As amended. House File motion is to refer House File 2857 as amended to the General Register. Mr. Brinks, please take the roll.
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson votes aye. Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Carlson votes aye. Representative Nash.
Aye.
Nash votes aye. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner votes aye. Representative Drazkowski.
Aye.
Drazkowski votes aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins aye.
Elkins votes aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman votes aye. Representative Cleburne.
Cleburne aye.
Cleburne votes aye. Representative Kosnick.
Aye.
Kosnick votes aye. Representative Mason.
Mason aye.
Mason votes aye. Representative New Brindley.
Aye.
New Brindley votes aye. Representative Pawlowski is excused. Representative Quam.
Aye.
Quam votes aye. Chair with a vote of 12 ayes and 1 excuse, the motion prevails.
The motion prevails. The bill's on its way to the General Register. Members, that's the last minute thing on our agenda. We have our next meeting is next Tuesday, March 15th. When they say beware the Ides of March. We have some bills on the agenda. We did add one to the agenda, the bill on Russian disinvestment, Representative Jordan. So members, with that, I hope you all have a good weekend. And with that, members, we are adjourned.